studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, September 21st, 2015. Base Nation, how U.S. military bases abroad harm America and the world. We'll speak with author David Vine. And Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein joins us live in studio to discuss the bizarre nature of American electoral politics, why she's running, and more. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks for joining us. Greek elections resulted in a second win for Syriza party leader Alexis Tsipras on Sunday. The embattled prime minister had faced growing uncertainty over his mandate after a stunning victory on an anti-austerity platform earlier this year and then a capitulation to creditors. The snap elections yesterday were a major risk and pollsters had been unable to predict a clear victory. But Mr. Tsipras's party emerged with a plurality of votes. Still, only 56% of Greek voters turned out to cast ballots, much lower than in the two elections earlier this year. In his victory speech, Tsipras said, "The mandate that the Greek people gave us is crystal clear to get rid of the wickedness and the regime of corruption and intertwined interests that have ruled the country for years." Syriza will likely form a coalition with the same party it had before, a right-wing populist party called Independent Greeks. Well, Chandra, it's strange that even Tsipras's language has changed from anti-austerity to tackling corruption, which is this vague catch-all phrase that so many politicians rely on. Are you disappointed by this turn in Greece, given how excited the left was over Syriza's initial win?
I think it is a little disappointing. Syriza showed great potential and served as an example of a radical left refusing to cede the realm of electoral politics to the exploitative austerity politics of the far right. But what I think we learn from this is that that kind of progressive threat to the status quo in Greece and elsewhere is often challenged by co-optation of that potential into a centrist kind of party. And as you pointed out, the language of corruption is indeed deeply problematic because it joins with the rhetoric of austerity that we've seen about Greece. Greece's problems in this narrative are mostly about corrupt individuals rather than an economic system that is a result of historical factors that won't be fixed by an increasingly entrenched austerity approach.
Here in the United States, Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson is facing a major backlash over Islamophobic comments that he made to the press. In conversation with NBC's Chuck Todd, Carson, who's African-American, said, "I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that." To that, Representative Keith Ellison, the first Muslim in Congress, who is also African-American, responded by issuing a statement saying, "The freedom of religion is a founding principle of our nation. For Ben Carson, Donald Trump, or any other Republican politician to suggest that someone of any faith is unfit for office is out of touch with who we are as a people. Every American should be disturbed that these national figures are engaging in and tolerating blatant acts of religious bigotry," said Carson. Even fellow Republicans Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich denounced Carson's statement. So far, Carson is standing by them. Chandra, it's better we see just who these candidates are so far ahead of the primary so that we know where they're coming from, right?
Right. But, well, you know, to be honest, I wouldn't have minded seeing Carson or Trump as the Republican nominee, thereby expediting the demise of that party. But, you know, I just want to point out the hateful rhetoric has real consequences. When we talk about, we can't forget Scott and Steve Leader, who were inspired by Trump to urinate on a homeless man a couple of weeks ago, then hit him in the head, punch several times, hit him in the head with a metal pole, and then walk away laughing. But, you know, I think when we think about Carson, we have his particular individual views, but we have to keep coming back to the fact that a disturbing amount of Americans agree with this. You know, according to a survey by Public Religion Research Institute and issued in conjunction with the Brookings Institution, 47% of Americans say they believe Muslim and American values are incompatible, and it can be broken down even further by political affiliation. 40% of Democrats say they believe that, as well as 66% of Tea Party members. And, you know, it's just, you know, 30% of Americans believe Muslims ultimately want to establish Sharia law as the law of the land. I mean, these are deeply worrisome numbers. So it's good. In a way, it's good that these things are coming out now because they allow for that conversation to happen sort of unshackled from the coded racial language that we've seen before.
And finally, actor Viola Davis made movie history last night when she became the first Black woman to win an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Drama Series. Davis plays the implacable criminal defense attorney and law professor Annalise Keating in the Shonda Rhimes series How to Get Away with Murder. In her acceptance speech, Davis said, "The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there." She also quoted civil rights icon Harriet Tubman. Quote, "In my mind, I see a line, and over that line, I see green fields and lovely flowers and beautiful white women with their arms stretched out to me over that line. But I can't seem to get there, no how. I can't seem to get over that line." Davis immediately came under fire for speaking out by white actress Nancy Lee Grahn from General Hospital, who tweeted, "Emmy's not venue for racial opportunity, all women belittled." Grahn later apologized, adding, I never mean to diminish her accomplishment. I wish I could get her roles." Chinjoy, how important was Davis's speech? I mean, she boldly called Hollywood out instead of just quietly accepting her award.
That's right. And it's really hard to make this kind of speech. There's tremendous political, cultural, and economic pressure not to do so in that context. You also don't have much time and you want to thank your colleagues. But Davis negotiated those things in a beautiful way and managed to launch her critique. And I really appreciated that her critique was a systemic one that focused on the lack of opportunity for other women of color rather than focusing on her own individual talents. You know, in some ways, what she said was not unlike Chris Rock's insight that these kind of moments are not necessarily representative of black progress as much as they're representative of white progress. And there, it's really a narrative of the progress of, Hollywood recognizing the talent that's always been there. And unfortunately, they're probably recognizing it now due to the fact that, you know, people like Shonda Rhimes have made it undeniable that it's economically profitable.
Well, Chinjoy, thanks as always for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Chinjoy Komanyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. And by the way, if you missed last week's banned broadcasts of Uprising on Thursday and Friday, which our general manager has decided not to air, you can visit UprisingWithSonali.com to listen to them. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Takeshi Onaga, the governor of the Japanese island of Okinawa, has decided to defy Japan's government, as well as the United States, in opposing the building of a new U.S. military base. Mr. Onaga was elected last year on the platform of opposing bases on Okinawa, which has long housed a military staging ground for the United States. Today, the U.S. has dramatically changed the way that it conducts its wars, increasingly relying on unmanned aerial vehicles or drones rather than ground troops. Still, its footprint on the globe, as measured by military bases, remains strong. There are currently a whopping 800 U.S. military bases around the world. According to my guest, David Vine, the United States likely has more bases in foreign lands than any other people, nation, or empire in history. David Vine's book is called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. He's an associate professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. His earlier book is Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. He's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and Mother Jones, and now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. Thanks for joining us. Well, let's take a look at history. Now, when were the majority of U.S. military bases built? It's not as though there's been this sort of steady one base here, one base there kind of build up over time, right? There was sort of one moment in history when a majority of the bases were built?
That's exactly right. There were a handful of U.S. bases outside United States territory going back to the 19th century, including Guantanamo Bay, which probably the most well-known base overseas, also Guam and Puerto Rico. But the vast majority of bases in this really huge network were built during and after World War II, especially during World War II with what was called the Destroyers for Bases deal, where before the United States' entrance into the war, President Roosevelt traded old World War One destroyers to Britain in exchange for 99-year leases on bases. And this was just the beginning of a massive buildup that accelerated once the United States entered World War II.
And why were all these bases built at that time? Was the U.S. taking advantage of a political moment where it had the upper hand?
Certainly, and already had ideas that it would get into the war, so it was positioning itself geopolitically both for the war itself and for the post-war era, which was on the minds of U.S. leaders from very early in the war and before the war, as we see.
You, in your book, map out where these military bases are. And I should add, today, it's not just the traditional military bases, but these so-called cooperative security locations, or so-called lily pads. Before we get to exactly how they are spread geographically, what is the typical military base, and what are these lily pads?
There really is a wide variety, and in the number, the estimate that I provide in the book of around 800 U.S. bases outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C., that really ranges from massive city-sized bases, and you might see, for example, in Okinawa or in Germany or South Korea, Italy, and a few other countries. These are bases with tens of thousands of troops and family members and schools and housing and shopping and fast food and beyond. And they range from there all the way down to these cooperative security locations or lily pads, as you said, which often have just a few hundred troops, sometimes host drones or surveillance aircraft, frequently have special forces operatives deployed from them. So it really is a very wide variety, but the one of the important dynamics that we see with these lily pad bases is that we're seeing U.S. lily pad bases in parts of the world where the United States hasn't had a military presence ever before, or perhaps had a very small presence during World War II. So parts of Africa, where most people in the United States, I think, have no clue that we have a military presence. Burkina Faso, for example, Ethiopia, Kenya, and as well as Central and Eastern Europe and parts of Asia, we're seeing these cooperative security locations.
And so would you say that these lily pads, as the colloquial name suggests, are sort of jumping off points for the U.S. or staging grounds for the U.S. at sort of small-scale military base that's semi-permanent?
I think the answer is absolutely yes, and that is by design. They are ready for expansion, significant expansion in some cases. So while they may, especially for people who have concerns about the tens of billions of dollars that we're spending on bases overseas and to maintain bases and troops overseas, small bases might sound appealing, much better than these city-sized bases that have been around for 70 years or more. But the cooperative security locations are designed for rapid expansion, and we've seen a trend with bases worldwide that once a base is established, it becomes very difficult to shut down, and frequently looks for things to do, looks for a reason to maintain its existence and to expand. So the cooperative security location trend is, to me, a troubling one for a number of reasons, including the possibility of enabling interventions of various sorts, and largely our huge network of bases has done that. It's often been described as defensive in nature. And to some extent, there might be an argument that was the case for some of them during the Cold War. But largely in the past several decades, these bases have made it, in my mind, far too easy to go to war, to launch wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular.
Well, the number of unconfirmed bases or lily pad bases, these cooperative security locations, seem to rival those confirmed numbers. Most of the unconfirmed ones are in various parts of southern, western Africa, also a couple in India and in Europe. Why are they unconfirmed? Are these military locations secret?
One of the motivations behind and one of the reasons these bases, these lily pad bases, are attractive to military and other leaders is that the hope is that they won't attract the kinds of opposition and protest that we see in places like Okinawa, where U.S. bases occupy around 20% of the main Okinawa Island, which is massive. If you think about what 20% of Delaware or Rhode Island being occupied by foreign troops and foreign bases. But so many of these bases are secretive because the U.S. and frequently host nations don't want to announce the presence of U.S. forces, or at least to proclaim it widely to national audiences, because they fear the kind of opposition and protest that has frequently been seen not just in Okinawa but worldwide when we have U.S. bases on foreign soil. And I think it is worth for U.S. audiences to think about what it would feel like to live next to a foreign base, next to foreign troops and weaponry, and have large swaths of cities and rural areas as well occupied by a foreign military.
Well, David, Okinawa is such a good example of this, and I opened our program, our conversation, with the latest situation there where opposition to a U.S. military base has gone on for a very long time. It stemmed from an ugly incident decades ago with the rape of a young girl by a U.S. soldier. Is that type of opposition at these established bases fairly common?
It is fairly common, and the opposition in Okinawa, in fact, dates back decades. The really horrific rape of 1995, there's no better way to describe it, set off an unprecedented opposition movement that has continued to today, but the opposition really does go back to shortly after World War II, when U.S. troops were formally occupying Okinawa and continued to occupy Okinawa until 1972, long after Japan had formally gained its independence after the post-World War II occupation. But even in countries like Italy and Germany, where there have been quite cordial relations between local populations and the U.S. military, you see opposition movements springing up, including in recent years. There have been quite considerable movements in Italy, for example, where the army wanted to build a new base in a town that had hosted several very large bases for upwards of 50 years. And people just said, you know what, it's been too long. We don't want another base taking up some of our last remaining green space in our town. This is a town called Vicenza near Venice. So we see a very wide pattern of protest, and in many cases, local movements have been successful in forcing the U.S. military to close spaces or to cut back planned expansion. One troubling development, unfortunately, is in the Philippines, where there was a massive national movement to get the U.S. military out that succeeded in 1992. Forcing the U.S. to leave two of its most important and largest bases overseas, Subic Bay and Clark Air Base. But there are reports in recent weeks and in the past year or two that the U.S. Navy is getting closer and closer to returning formally to the Subic Bay base, while the military has had upwards of 600 troops at around seven bases, actually, since 2002, in much the way that the lily pad strategy has allowed basically a secretive presence to operate. Frequently, these bases are, as they are in the Philippines, within host nation bases to disguise their presence and to keep the possibility of protest down.
Well, lest we think that the U.S. is being somehow singled out for protest over its military bases, I think it's important at this point to remind ourselves that there is no other country that compares to the United States in its military reach through its bases around the world, right?
That's exactly right. There are a few other countries that have foreign bases. Russia, Britain, France are the prime ones, and a few other countries have one base outside their own territory. But if you combine all those countries, they have about 30 foreign bases among them, compared to the around 800 the United States possesses. So the United States possesses around 95% of the world's foreign bases. And the central argument in my book, Base Nation, is that while the automatic assumption might be, and really has been since World War II, that these bases make us stronger, that they make the nation more secure, that more bases equals more security, and security not just for the United States, for the globe, that after 14 years of research, in my case, I've found that frequently these bases are actually making us less secure and making people around the world less secure in a variety of ways, beginning with the costs that U.S. taxpayers bear, $85 billion to maintain bases and troops overseas per year.
That's amazing.
And that doesn't even include the costs in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we still have bases and troops. And that, if you include that, we get up to $156 billion a year. And I think we should think about what we're not investing in when we invest in bases overseas, the crumbling infrastructure at home in our schools, our housing, our roads, while we have this very robust infrastructure overseas that frequently is actually exacerbating military tensions and leading to radicalization. And in the Middle East in particular, there's a correlation between the presence of U.S. bases and troops and al-Qaeda recruitment. These bases are really designed for the Cold War, and in my mind have long outlived their usefulness in most cases. And I think it's long past time that we look very carefully at every single base and whether the base is needed, whether it is in fact making the United States or the world more secure in any way.
Now, do you think that that president after president continues to approve the funding and maintenance cost of these military bases or even expands them because it's this sort of inertia left over from World War II? And as you said, once the base is established, they look, you know, there's of course a searching out of a reason to use them, much like how local police feel like they have to keep using resources that are allocated to them lest they lose them the next year. Is there just this sort of political and financial inertia that enables the bases to continue to operate?
I think there are a number of reasons why we've seen these bases continue to operate over time, why we've seen this huge infrastructure of bases remain in place more than two decades after the end of the Cold War. Some of it's political, some of it's, I think, economic, some of it's ideological even. The assumption that's been a primary tenet of U.S. foreign policy that the United States must maintain very large numbers of bases and hundreds of thousands of troops overseas to protect its security. I think partly there's just an inability to think beyond that assumption from the Cold War and World War II. Part of it is economic as well, that there are some military contractors that have been making billions of dollars on these bases to build them and maintain them over time. They clearly have an interest in seeing that system maintained. Even though much of the money doesn't end up coming back to the United States, much of it ends up staying in foreign economies or in the foreign bank accounts of U.S. and foreign contractors. And then I think there's the political dimension is that both foreign politicians and members of Congress become quite attached to these bases. In the case of the U.S. Congress, I think U.S. members have largely abdicated their responsibility to oversee the Pentagon's operations abroad. They've largely let the Pentagon have its way and asked very few questions about why we have so many bases overseas, why we would need to expand them, why we would need to build new bases in Germany, for example, at the very moment that we've actually been closing some bases in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. So I think once the bases become entrenched in communities overseas, they really entrench themselves in the local political economy. So locals as well, you see a range of opinions, but not surprisingly, some locals are very attached because they work on the bases or their businesses depend on the presence of the bases, even though there's a lot of research that shows that the bases are really not a very good economic development strategy, and that once bases close, despite the fears, very understandable fears of many locals, communities can actually end up economically stronger for the closure of the base because they can use the land for other purposes that are actually much more economically productive.
And actually on that issue, the use of land, David Vine, in your book, Base Nation, you also talk about how the U.S. military bases are an environmental scourge, right?
That's exactly right. And it is one of the problems with reusing and converting U.S. bases. There is just such widespread environmental damage on U.S. bases, and it's really not a problem unique to the United States. Military bases, by definition, are pretty much are home to toxic materials, weaponry, things that harm the environment. So we've seen bases worldwide, unexploded ordnance, expended ordnance, the toxic spills, both accidental and in some cases the deliberate dumping of toxic and hazardous waste in the soil and water supplies. So this is another major problem and way, very direct way, in which our bases overseas are harming people around the world. At the same time, and this is how I came to look at the issue of overseas bases. Like most U.S. Americans, I didn't think about it at all. Until 14 years ago, I learned of the case of Diego Garcia. This is a case where the land to create a base was simply taken from indigenous people living in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And there are, unfortunately, around 18, at least 18 other cases I've been able to find where the U.S. military has displaced and local people and taken land as part of the creation or expansion of U.S. bases overseas.
Now, let's also talk about the map. And I brought this up earlier. If we look at the map of U.S. military bases and where they're present and where they're not present, they seem to be so sort of uniformly peppered around the world. But there are two pretty large blank spots, and those are predictably Russia and China. Does that map really reflect the U.S.'s and the current political and military dynamics in the world between the U.S., Russia, and China? And, you know, we see these bases surrounding Russia and China, but there are no Russian or Chinese bases surrounding the United States, are there?
There are not. And again, I think it's for people in the United States, it's worth thinking how we would react if there was even a single Chinese or Russian base anywhere near U.S. soil. I think we would very rapidly see a hue and cry for a buildup of military forces. And I think we tend not to see the way in which other countries might perceive our bases. We describe them as purely defensive in nature. But, you know, if you're China, how do you react to being encircled by U.S. bases? There are hundreds of U.S. bases in East Asia and have been for decades before the President Obama's Pacific pivot, as it were, his plan to build up U.S. forces in the region. I think it's one of the scariest aspects of our base network overseas is that these bases can really become something of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Some of the justification for the buildup in East Asia is basically to check China's growth and its increasing military power. But when you increase U.S. military presence in the region, it's only encouraging China to continue to build up its military presence and military forces, and really in many ways can make war more likely rather than less likely. So I think it really is worth thinking about how the world looks from the other side. And Base Nation really argues that these bases, for many of the reasons I've tried to outline here, are making us more secure, and that we need to find another way. We need to find a way to use our diplomatic tools rather than this toolbox that has been chock full of foreign policy toolbox that's been chock full of bases and the use of military power.
So finally, let's talk about whether there are movements here in the United States, because, of course, movements exist around the world, individual movements, local movements to oppose U.S. military bases. Is there a concerted effort in the United States where it's arguably the most important, maybe not even arguably, where it is the most important for us, since we have the most power, to lobby our Congress, the Pentagon, the President, the White House, to stop the funding and close down these bases?
That's absolutely right. I think in this case, pressure by local citizens can really make a big difference, especially as budget debates have been dominating a lot of the conversation on Capitol Hill for recent years, and this fall are likely to again. U.S. bases overseas are an easy target. They are an easy way to save money very quickly. And one of the really encouraging signs for me is that there are people across the political spectrum who are realizing that closing bases and cutting back the expansion of bases can be a quick way to both save money and actually improve our national security at the same time. It's not surprising there are members of Congress who realize that if you close bases in Germany, you bring troops back to the United States, those troops then can be living in their communities and their taxpayer-funded salaries can be going into local economies rather than into the German economy. So we really see some strange bedfellows, libertarians, Republicans of various stripes and people on the left, coming together and not coming together enough, I would say at this point, but certainly fundamentally agreeing in principle for various and different reasons, I think, but agreeing that we need to look at these overseas bases much more carefully and begin closing ones that are simply unnecessary and actually making us less secure.
Well, I want to thank you so much, David, for joining us. Would you like to give out a website and where can people find out more about your writings?
Indeed. You can find out more about Base Nation at basenation.us, basenation.us, where actually the map that you referenced from the book is available, as well as a couple other maps. And there's more of my writing can be found at davidvine.net, davidvine.net.
And we'll post those links to uprisingwithsonali.com later today. David, thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck with your book.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure.
David Vine's book is called Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. He's an associate professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. His earlier book was called Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. This is Uprising. When we come back, presidential candidate with the Green Party, Jill Stein, joins us live in studio. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The U.S. electoral political system is a very strange one by design. A historic stranglehold by the two major parties has created a fairly narrow set of issues with a very strong polarization on some issues. While we're forced to fight one another over social wedges, corporate and military hegemony, racism, and state power can continue unabated. But for years, the Green Party has been attempting to break into the political process. And this year, one presidential candidate is unabashedly declaring that she wants, quote, people, planet, and peace over profit. I'm very pleased to welcome Jill Stein to Uprising. She is the presumptive Green Party nominee for president who ran in 2012 when she was also on our program. She has also run twice for governor of Massachusetts. She is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, has practiced internal medicine before turning to politics. She's a longtime activist. Welcome back to the program, Jill.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Really great to be here.
It's been 3 years since we had you live in studio. And so there's so much to discuss here. First, I want to break up our interview into two parts. One on, which is your agenda, what mm-hmm. you stand for. But then given that you are sort of an outsider to the two-party political system, I want to get your comments and commentary on the political process as it's playing out, particularly mm-hmm. given what a long lead time we have between now and this 2016 election. So first, let's talk about you. You have a very clear agenda, as many Green Party candidates have had over the years. And one of the issues that is actually being echoed in the mainstream by Bernie Sanders is your agenda on student debt, on higher education. We have a crisis in this country on higher education. Can you explain why this is an important position for you on addressing student debt?
Yes. You know, it's just tragic to see how a whole generation has basically been locked into debt that they cannot repay because the jobs are not there to enable them to repay debt, let alone to, you know, meet the cost of housing and health care. And it's just tragic. And as a mother and citizen, you know, I have to say this is one of the issues that gets me out of bed, you know, fighting angry every morning, to think, you know, that you have these young people walking around carrying basically a mortgage on their back without a house to show for it and without a means of paying down that mortgage. It's absolutely stunning, especially when you think our generation, we had a high school education as a right, provided for free, because that's what you needed in order to have a secure start in life. Now you need a college education to have a secure start in life. So our view, you know, number one, is that that should be provided for free. We know that it pays for itself by the GI Bill. We were keeping close track of what was the cost and the benefit. And we know for every dollar invested in the college education of returning soldiers following the Second World War, for every dollar put in, $7 were returned. So this is actually a beneficial investment, which makes it all the more outrageous that this is going on. But the way that we differ actually from the Sanders campaign is that we are not only calling and have been calling for forever, really, for free public higher education, but we are also calling for a cancellation of student debt. We did this for the bankers to the tune of $17 trillion. We've been bailing out Wall Street. Wall Street, who actually caused this crisis in our economy, and young people are the victims of that crashed economy, which hasn't recovered. It's recovered for maybe the top 10%. But for the average American, we're in an emergency, not a recovery. And here are young people who had nothing to do with this economic crisis. They're bearing the burden of it. They need to be bailed out. And we actually know that that bailout would be a very beneficial and productive bailout that would unleash the creative genius of the younger generation, which is what we always rely on to re-envision our economy and
right.
our society.
You know, President Obama invited Ahmed Mohammed, the 14-year-old boy from Texas, to come to the White House. And while this young boy is getting a lot of attention right now for being targeted by the police and his principal and even the mayor of his town in Irving, Texas, what would happen to Ahmed Mohammed if he went to college only to find himself deeply in debt and not many job prospects once he graduated, which is the prospect that so many young kids find themselves in today at a time when universities are being run as businesses mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. are quite flush with cash. A recent report just showed that, and are simply still charging outrageous tuition. We have to sort of change the very nature of higher education, it seems, in this country.
We absolutely do. We have to go back to educating. Right now, you know, all these, the growth in these budgets of colleges and universities have largely to do with their sports facilities and having fancy gyms, hiring more administrators. It's kind of comparable to what's going on in the healthcare system, where you have this proliferation of purely administrative, useless, money sink kinds of costs. So we need to get down to the business of educating. And providing free public higher education would do an enormous good for bringing down the cost of education in our private institutions, too. And the last thing I want to say about this is that there are 40 million young people who are in debt, and essentially who are debt slaves, who are indentured servants without the ability to repay it. And this is in a very predatory kind of debt out of which there is no bankruptcy escape and with high interest rates. So We're trying to get out the word that if 40 million people came out to vote to cancel their debt, that's enough to win a 3 or 4 way presidential race. Mm. So we're encouraging young people to feel empowered here to make this race a referendum on public higher education and student debt. And let's vote to end it. And however far we get is going to be a very powerful force, an unstoppable force. Whether we win the office or we simply win the day, we put this issue on record because right now it's nowhere to be found. It's only in our campaign that we're really pushing the abolition of student debt.
Well, the other major issue that you take a stand on boldly and that is in the news quite a lot these days is the issue of women's right to an abortion. The House just voted to cut off federal funding for Planned Parenthood. That federal funding doesn't even actually fund abortions. It actually just simply funds healthcare screenings and healthcare in general for poor women, women who can't afford women's healthcare elsewhere. And we still often sort of apologize for, you know, women wanting the right to an abortion. You come from the healthcare field. Do you simply take a strong stand on what can be a divisive issue that women need to have the right to an abortion if they want it?
Yes. And I try to put it in the context of health. You know, this is a reproductive health decision that a woman has a right to make, you know, with the advice and support of her healthcare providers, period. This is not a public issue. It's not an issue of government. This is simply a matter to control your own body and a woman's own healthcare. And women should have access to all of the technology and the strategies and all of the medical possibilities for addressing reproductive health, and that includes the right to an abortion as well as, you know, the right to comprehensive reproductive health care, contraception, family planning, all the rest. This, as far as I'm concerned, is not a matter of public policy. This is a matter of private health care, period.
The issue of race and racism, police brutality, et cetera, has become a very important one over the past year. It's always been important, but it's now edged into or broken into the mainstream media discourse. Bernie Sanders faced criticism for not tackling it head on. He seems to have responded. You went to Ferguson in July. You spoke out against racism and white supremacy. This was about just before the 1 year anniversary of Mike Brown's death. How important is it for presidential candidates to address the Ferguson moment that we're in?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. And as you point out, this is not a new moment. It is just, you know, the outrage of racism that's imbued in the culture, not only in policing, courts, and prisons, but really in every dimension of life, in education, in hiring, in housing, in health. There is a, you know, a very harmful systemic racism that has real consequences. This is not, you know, simply an abstract concern. This all has consequences. In health, for example, we know that the average African American, combined with educational discrimination, you put those two things together, it's a 14-year loss of life. That's 14 years that life is shortened. And you see this all around, you know, among your friends, among my diverse network. I'm seeing African-American men in particular get really sick as they enter their late 50s and 60s, and not so for the Caucasians. And, you know, it's not only the health care that you have access to, but it's also the hardships, the stresses,
the trauma of racism.
The trauma and, indeed, the pollution and the environmental injustice, which is racially based as well. So these are really critical issues. We have to address them. Our campaign has adopted the basic position of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which is that we basically call for a national action plan for racial justice now, which addresses, you know, it addresses racist policing, the militarization, the prison state, drug policy, as well as, you know, segregation of our schools, which are resegregating, and our housing is resegregating. All of these things need to be addressed.
So people can find out much more about your entire platform. We could fill hours talking about it. They can find out online about it. So I want to talk a little bit about strategy, about how our system of elections in the United States is set up against outsiders. However, I'm going to try to paraphrase what I think are my Bernie Sanders supporters, friends of mine who are Bernie Sanders supporters, that, you know, it's unheard of for us to have somebody like Bernie Sanders jump into the race so forcefully, pack houses, drawing tens of thousands, 50,000 people in event after event after event. Progressives are very excited about Bernie Sanders, very, very, very excited. And I'm wondering if you're receiving the critique this year during your run that now is not the time for a Jill Stein candidacy because we got Bernie Sanders, who might have a shot at beating Hillary Clinton. He's actually edged her out of the polls in some states. Are you getting flack for trying to edge in on Sanders' lock on the left? Are you getting the Nader treatment?
You know, maybe I'm oblivious to it because I've learned to live that it's never the time. It's never the time to move outside of the corporate political system. And they will come up with all kinds of reasons why you can't. But I've actually found a very collegial relationship with the Sanders campaign because, you know, I make the point that the Democratic Party has a kill switch, and that kill switch is called the money primaries or the, you know, the whatever it is, you know, when there are all those primaries happening on the same day in March, where you need hundreds of millions of dollars in order to handle the TV advertising and to do well to prevail in those primaries. So that is part of the kill switch. And the other piece is the superdelegates, which were created after George McGovern managed to do this. You know, so Bernie, bless his heart, and bless all of his supporters for raising these issues. But unfortunately, Bernie's not the first. And we've seen enormous enthusiasm for Jesse Jackson's campaign, for Howard Dean's campaign. You know, in those campaigns, you saw the complete abandonment by the party of George McGovern once he actually did win the race. So the party basically dropped out, and he, you know, was the biggest loser in any presidential race in history. In the case of Howard Dean, you saw the Dean scream. Suddenly, this public relations campaign to slam him and bring him down in public opinion polls. You know, and I think also he's benefiting from Hillary Clinton's slide, but we may see a Joe Biden come in and capture the wave. So there are all kinds of reasons why the Bernie team doesn't want to be caught shorthanded and be forced, sort of force-fed into the corporate Democrat, whoever takes over from Bernie. And I found that most Bernie supporters acknowledge there is a real possibility. They're quick to point out that we're facing a steep uphill battle, but the difference is that we don't go away, not after the primary. We don't go away in November. This is about building an opposition party. And you can look at the case of Syriza in Greece. Now, Syriza has problems of its own. It's not a done deal, but it demonstrates how you can go from absolutely invisible 1 year to 3% a few years later, and then to become the dominant party when conditions are right. And we are certainly in one of those points of, you know, just dramatic converging crises where things are incredibly in flux. People are are tearing their hair out with their political options at this point, being the Democrats and Republicans. 50% of Americans now, according to a recent Wall Street Journal poll, do not identify as either Democrat or Republican. We're trying to push into the debates because why is it that half of Americans should have their voices locked out of debates? We should have legitimate candidates.
I want to get to the strategy that your party has adopted to that. But just going back to Sanders, Chris Hedges sees a big difference between you and Bernie Sanders. He was on our program last week saying he would not support Sanders, and he spoke alongside you at an event in Orange County over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Where do you and Sanders agree with one another, and where do you disagree, if you can sort of, in a nutshell, express that? I know that's a big question, but how do you convince somebody who's a Sanders supporter before the primary to support you?
It's a tough sell, just because people tend to get dug in to their political positions. But, you know, I do emphasize that if people care about militarism, you know, if they care about Palestinian human rights, if they care about the military economy.
That's his weak point. Yeah, Sanders' weak point.
Absolutely. Sanders supports our $8 million a day support to the Netanyahu government, a government which is in flagrant violation of international law, has committed war crimes, is engaged in occupation, you know, and Sanders supports $8 million a day that we provide to the Israeli military. We do not. We do not support actually funding for any government that is abusing human rights and international law, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Whereas Bernie's talking about, well, we should support, you know, Saudi Arabia, give them more weapons and support for fighting ISIS. Our point is that ISIS is a creation of a failed American policy, that we need to go back to the drawing boards and dismantle this policy of essentially total military and economic domination, and essentially begin a foreign policy based on international law and human rights, period.
Now, what do you think will happen if and when Sanders is not picked for the Democratic Party nominee? He's likely to back Hillary Clinton. At that point, there's going to be a scramble for Clinton to try to win over Sanders supporters, but it also represents a big opening for the Green Party to win over Sanders supporters.
Exactly. And, you know, we plan to host all sorts of change parties where we will administer first aid for people who have first or second, third degree burns, if you know what I mean.
Nice.
And help people break up with an abusive political relationship. And I don't mean with Bernie, I mean with the Democratic Party, which is forever trying to rein people in while the party continues to march to the right. And that's one thing I do try to point out, is that while there have been incredibly inspired and wonderful rebels within the Democratic Party, the party uses that as cover in order to become more corporatized, more militarized, more abusive of civil liberties and racial justice and immigrant rights. It's really important to look at the record of the party and how it essentially squelches efforts to get to the bottom of this, to get the power of corporations or the power of money out of the party. And they don't do that. Sometimes that brings people around and wakes them up. But that's what we'll be engaged in. And we're hoping to work with Bernie supporters so that they have a plan B. Or if they consider Bernie plan B, maybe they have a plan A, so that when the Bernie pathway has been shut down, which it's overwhelmingly, you know, the odds are it's going to get shut down, they have another pathway. And what we're telling people is that you don't want that pathway to be shut down in advance. We need to build it now so that when they need a lifeboat, they have a place to come and we can have a vigorous campaign. Because what we're going to be left with, if not two legacy candidates, a Bush and a Clinton, you know, it'll be close to that. And it's really time to stand up. I think it's no coincidence that people are thronging to Bernie now because they don't want to be in the Democratic Party. They don't like where it's gone and what it represents. But unfortunately, it's an illusion that that can be changed from within the party that has sold out.
So the progressive discourse that Bernie represents, and that's arguable, Hedges would take issue with that, I know, but for many, it is a progressive discourse that he represents, is in the mainstream debate right now, if and when he gets pushed out of the primaries, that gets shut down, but it could continue with you. What is your plan to break into the debates?
Great. So we have two lawsuits, one of which has been filed, the other one is about to be, that basically declare the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is essentially a front group for the Democratic and Republican National Committees, it declares them in violation of the law. The federal election law requires that the debates actually be nonpartisan, not bipartisan. And so they really haven't kept pace with the times, as the near majority, or at least half the American public, has left those parties. So we're taking them to court on that basis. And we have a petition right now, a petition which you can get to on our website, jill2016.com, that would essentially open the debates to legitimate candidates who are choices on the ballots of at least half of voters, so that voters have not only a right to vote, we have a right to know who it is that we can vote for. That should not be kept secret. It should not be kept off the table. If that rule were in force, there would typically be about four people, occasionally five, occasionally less, in a debate, and actually make it an interesting, challenging, and empowering debate, instead of carefully constraining people to two candidates who support the same vision of corporatism, militarism, imperialism, exporting jobs, you know,
And the primary debates showed that they can be, you know, that you can balance 11 or 12 people, as many as 11 or 12 people.
Exactly. And it needn't even be that. I mean, it would actually be more like four or five. If it were more, you could have elimination debates. Mm-hmm. So there are ways you can do it.
Now, are you planning on teaming up with libertarians and other smaller parties to try to get into the debates?
Yes. In fact, these court cases are filed jointly between the Green Party and the Libertarian Party, and myself, as well as Gary Johnson. We are plaintiffs in one of the cases, which has candidates. But the parties are involved in both. And we've been actually teaming up quite a bit since the last election, where there were several debates that we held independently, including Democracy Now! Held their debates, where they interrupted the big debates to allow us time to actually answer the questions. And people who listened to those debates found it so incredibly therapeutic and healing to hear after the incredible, torture, really, that it is to listen to the Democratic and Republican debates.
And of course, a huge part of our problem is the Electoral College system, which really narrows and filters out voices and opposition. And it seems so clearly designed to reduce this into one party against another, two major parties. Whereas in other countries, you can have a Syriza-like party emerge in a place like Greece. In the United States, no matter how hard you try, even if you get into the debates, the Electoral College system stymies you right at the very end on that very last day of the election.
That's right. There's no silver bullet here that's going to completely fix it, but the debates are one way that you can begin to crack open, the prison gates. There are several, we could simply make the airwaves, which belong to the public, free, to qualified candidates. That would essentially take the power of money out of the elections. There are so many ways that we can begin to open the system up. And to my mind, the key thing is that we recognize our power to do this. 40 million students, could win this election. Put that together with, one in three African Americans held hostage by the prison system, the power of the Latino vote, the Latinos who are
here. If the victims of the current system got out and focused on one party, you'd probably be in a good place.
Exactly. If they can only hear that they actually have something to vote for.
Well, Jill, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much,
Sanaa. My guest, Jill Stein, is the Green Party candidate for president. You can find out more about her work and her platform at jill2016.com. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com, where you can find all of the links that we mention on the air. Follow us at facebook.com/uprisingradio. Follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.